Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th Canto, Chapter 22, entitled Prithu Maharaj's Meeting with the Kumaras, text number 17. It's not on the board, but it does start with Maitreya Uvacha. So I'm going to chant that. Maitreya Uvacha Pritostatsukta Makarnya Saram Sustu Mitam Madhu Smaya mana iva pritya Kumara pratyuvachaha Maitreya uvacha. The great sage Maitreya continued to speak. Prito of King Prithu. Tat that. Shuktam, Vedic conclusion. Akarnya, hearing. Saram, very substantial. Shustu, appropriate. Mitam, minimized. Madhu, sweet to hear. I think the Spanish is so loud that he can't even keep it on his ears. Even I can hear it. Shustu, appropriate. Mitam, minimized. Madhu, sweet to hear. Smayamana, smiling. Eva, like. Pritya, out of great satisfaction. Kumara, celibate. Pratyuvacha, replied. Ha, thus. Translation. The great sage Maitreya continued. Thus, Sanat Kumar, the best of the celibates, after hearing the speech of Prithu Maharaj, which was meaningful, appropriate, full of precise words, and very sweet to hear, smiled with full satisfaction and began to speak as follows. Purport. Prithu Maharaj's talks before the Kumaras were very laudable because of so many qualifications. A speech should be composed of selected words, very sweet to hear, and appropriate to the situation. Such speech is called meaningful. All these good qualifications are present in Prithu Maharaj's speech because he is a perfect devotee. It is said, Yasyasti Bhakti Bhagavati Akinchana Sarvir Gunais Tatasamasare Sura. For one who has unflinching devotional faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is engaged in his service, all good qualities become manifest in his person. Bhagavatam 5.18.12. Thus the Kumaras were very much pleased, and Sanat Kumar began to speak as follows. So, in the last few days, we have been hearing how Prithu Maharaj was glorifying the four Kumaras and welcoming them. And in welcoming them, Prithu Maharaj said, there is no point in asking you about your welfare. There is no need to ask if you're doing well or not well, because a devotee is always doing well. That was the point. So, therefore, there's no point in asking this question. Then, Prithu Maharaj established the transcendental nature of the four Kumaras, how they were never affected by the material energy, but always fixed in transcendence, and therefore always fixed in happiness. He also pointed out that they were totally transcendental personalities, and as such, the direct representatives of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to fulfill the purpose of the Lord, who always is concerned with the well-being of all living beings. And thus the four Kumaras were incarnations of the mercy of the Lord. Just like it is said that the spiritual master is the external mercy manifestation of the Lord. The Lord manifests his mercy in so many ways, and he is known as Chaitya Guru, the spiritual master within the heart. But it's difficult to get a connection with the spiritual master in the heart because there are so many other things in the heart as well. So sometimes it is difficult to figure out, is this the Supreme Lord who is revealing his desire, or is this my own mind? Right? It is difficult. So many have acted upon the order of the Lord, and it wasn't always correct. There was Charles Manson, who killed a famous movie star and later said that he did it because God told him to do it. Yeah. So yes, one cannot always rely on the inner voice. Or there was one devotee, he had a dream of Prabhupada, and Prabhupada appeared in his dream, and Prabhupada told him, you have to become the next Acharya in ISKCON. This was in the mid-80s, right? But it didn't work. When he woke up, no one listened to him. No one took his dream very serious, right? What to say. It is so difficult to know, when is Prabhupada speaking to us in a dream, or when is our mind speaking to us in the form of Prabhupada, right? Like that, it is not so easy to understand what is Krishna, what is not Krishna. Therefore, the spiritual master is immediately taking one of the mental platform by saying, this is Krishna conscious and that is not. And then, that's it. So in this way, Prithu Maharaj had glorified the four Kumaras in such a way that he had spoken about their qualities. He was not just glorifying at random. If we go around and just start saying, Prabhu, you are a Paramahansa, while we're seeing that in reality there is a nice devotee there, but he's still struggling sometimes, then it is artificial to say you are a Paramahansa. And such kind of glorification is not meaningful. But if one actually glorifies a Vaishnava for the actual good qualities that one can see and recognize in that Vaishnava, then such glorification is a purification for the person who is glorifying. Because then actually we are giving due respect to others. And in this way, we are ourselves taking the humble position. This is very important, to appreciate Vaishnavas and to find their good qualities. There used to be a little management book flying around in ISKCON. It was called the One Minute Manager. Right? And the whole thing about this One Minute Manager was that he would only give like 1 minute instructions to anybody, right, in his management. That was the main theme in the book. But that's not the reason why I'm quoting it. In this book, there was one other thing. And that was that usually managers, they are busy trying to catch people doing something wrong. And then they, when it's wrong, then they point it out, you know. How could you blow it like this, you know? I mean, this is like, don't you have any brain, right? I mean, look, you know, you did it again. How many times do I have to tell you? Now, please pay attention and do it properly. Right? This kind of mood can be there when the manager is in the mood of catching faults. So in this book it said that the manager should not do that. He should not catch faults. Rather, he should catch people doing something right. Right? It's not always easy. But anyway, waiting and waiting and finally, yes. Oh, that's... You did that really well. Fantastic. Wonderful. Wow. I'm impressed, you know. It's so nice you did this. But it must be true. Right? So this is actually borrowed from the Vaishnava philosophy, right? Because this is actually our own system, that we are meant to catch someone do something right. Seeing the kids playing around, it brings to mind that parents do the same thing, right? They also have to reconfirm all the time their children when they do something right, you know. Oh, you can ride this bicycle. Oh, fantastic. I mean, you know, millions of people in the world can ride bicycles, right? Nothing special. But when a kid rides a bicycle, they're just like, wow, you can do this. Wow, on two wheels, really. Amazing. On one wheel, even. Watch out now. In this way, we appreciate, and when children are appreciated like that, then later on they have good self-confidence and self-esteem, and they are people that can, you know, have an high EQ, right? Not IQ, but EQ, you know, they are emotionally very strong and they can function very well in the world, etc. Whereas when you have parents who are always putting the kids down, you know, saying like, you know, do you have any brain or what, you know? I mean, are you totally useless or just 99%, right? And in this way, one can gradually crush the ego, and after some time the kid is thinking, I am useless, I can't do anything, I'm a klutz, I'm hopeless, I may as well jump off a bridge, right? And he gets suicidal. So, in the same way, in Krishna consciousness, this recognizing of the glories of a Vaishnava is essential and genuine. It is part of genuine relationships. Therefore, although there is Vaishnav etiquette, and in Vaishnav etiquette one gives respect to the senior Vaishnav, etc., etc., still, Vaishnav etiquette is not just meant to be a hollow ritual. Right? Vaishnav etiquette is meant to be meaningful, and Vaishnav etiquette is meant to be based on the truth. And this is what Prithu Maharaj was manifesting here. And in the course of glorifying the four Kumaras, he was being purified. And the four Kumaras were very pleased. So, when a Vaishnava speaks, right, it depends very much on the audience what he will say. It's not a conscious matter, but when the audience is very cynical, if the audience is sitting, well, what's the guy going to say? Let me see if he says something that's off. Wouldn't surprise me. Usually they do, right? You know, it's a matter of waiting till he reveals, you know, his misconceptions, right? I'm sure that they're there. Let's wait a little longer. So far, I guess the Siddhanta was okay, but it can't last long. I'm sure he's going to make a slip soon. Right? If one gives a lecture in front of such a forum, naturally, one is not so inclined. I gave one lecture once, and someone asked a question at the end of the lecture, and the question was, how do we know that you're not going to fall down? Right? And all throughout the lecture, I already saw that look, you know, in the eyes, and I was thinking kind of like, what question's going to come? So, there is a, in the process of sravanam kirtanam, of hearing and chanting, there must be a favorable attitude, an attitude of appreciation. If the audience is very, very eager, then the speaker may say things that he had never realized before. He may find that there are treasures in his heart that he didn't even know he had. That may happen. He may say things that are realizations that are just coming at that particular moment. Because, after all, speaking on Srimad Bhagavatam or on the glories of the Lord or on the glories of a Vaishnava is not an ordinary thing and is done with great concentration. And because of the great concentration, one is actually meditating very deeply on the Lord and on the meaning of the words of the scriptures or on the qualities of the Vaishnava. And in this way, one may get realizations that one previously did not have, because never before did one speak or meditate with so much concentration. Therefore, the process of sravanam kirtanam is the foundation of the Vaishnav culture. This is what will give us more and more a vision in life. By regularly attending such discussions on spiritual subject matter, we are gradually developing a vision of what is the goal of life and how to achieve it. It is very important that in spiritual life one develops a vision. One cannot just be part of this movement and let it all just happen.
I'm part of this and it's just going on and, I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow, but I guess it's devotional service because I'm like that.
That's not the right attitude. The attitude is that we should understand what is the goal of life and how am I going to attain it? How am I going to approach it? What is my plan? What do I need? We are distinct individuals with particular need. So, therefore, we should understand how to get there in Krishna consciousness. What problems can we expect to deal with on the way, and how do we deal with it? Like, for example, the other day it was pointed out that sex desire is very, very strong. Lust is such a force, it is attacking the entire world, and everyone in this world is influenced by it, right? So the question, how to deal with it, right, seems to be an essential question for anyone and everyone in his life. This question will address itself. One is therefore expected to deal with it, right? So there are answers to this. This is very important that we have a vision. Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he wrote this book called A Hare Krishna in the SMU, which were essays that he had written in the course of his studies. And in one of these essays, he was writing about ritual and about the value of ritual. And he was explaining that in modern society, there is no more ritual. We have stripped life from any ritual, from tradition. Everything is just spontaneous, you know. Just do it, just feel it, you know, and just let it all hang out as they sing in the songs, right? And this is the philosophy. So just in that way, let it all happen. No system, no culture. Whereas the traditional cultures or traditional societies, they had rituals, right? Certain things you were supposed to do because that's the way it's done. Right, and if you don't do it like that, everyone will say shame, shame, shame on you. So then you do. But in the 60s, we had the Cultural Revolution, and we threw all that out. We had to forget it. You know, we don't want this ritual anymore. We want to be free, freedom. Right? We sang with guitars in our hands. Me too. I also joined that. You know, freedom, freedom. Right? But true freedom does not exist in this way. So ritual or certain customs or practices or etiquette are certainly helpful. They teach us to deal with our with the various stages of our life very nicely. It is like, I can give an example, that at each stage of life there is a different priority. When we are in our first year, then the priority is clearly food, right? Anamoy, the mother. That is the mother and breast milk. That is the essence of life. That's what it's all about, and that's what you want, and nothing else. That's the only thing, right? But when you're 10 years old, then it's different. When you're 10 years old, right, you want to sport and play, and you know, you want to a little action, right? You want some things. You want a super bicycle. You want to play with a ball. Maybe some computer games nowadays. 10 years old, right? There you go, you know. That's life, right? Totally different priority. When you're 20 again, oh, life is different again. There's romance and there is so many things so nice. You know, suddenly clothes become important, you know, like suddenly the way your hair is, it means something. You know, everything, right? Looks is what it's all about, you know. You pose in front of the mirror, different smile. Right. 20, right. 30 is again a different thing. At 30, you try to think like, well, maybe it's time to settle down. Right. At 40, you think, well, you know, I guess, you know, I've seen it by now, you know. Like, I know what life is all about, you know. You can't pull the wool over my eyes, you know. I know what's going on in this world, okay? You know, I've been around, you know. When you're 50, you start thinking like, well, you know, like it's quite a pace to keep up with the rat race, right? You know, I mean, I'm not so eager anymore, you know. For me, I've done it all, you know. I've done all these things. I don't need to do them so much anymore, you know. That's okay. That's 50. When you're 60, the mood becomes, well, still young, you know. Still young, no, only 60, you know. Trying to hide it, you know, how old you are. At 70,
it doesn't work anymore.
You may think you're still young, but everybody else knows, you know. You're over the hill, you're croaking, you're finished. You can die any moment now. And every week a funeral, you know. At 80, it's quite a feat, you know. At 90, it's incredible. At 100, in Holland, the mayor comes on your birthday personally to your house to congratulate you, right? Because it doesn't happen that often. So even the busy mayor can find time for that, you know. Anything over 100, you know, is like getting kind of out of the ordinary, almost mystic. And maybe yogis, you know. Like in Vrindavan, there was this Oriya Baba, and they said he was 400 years old. Yes. Because yogis can do that. Yogis and frogs can do that, actually. Yeah, frogs also. They know the art of kumbhaka, the art of balancing the ingoing breath and the outgoing breath and then bringing it to a stop. Not only yogis can do it, frogs can also do it, Srila Prabhupada said. Okay? So, in this way, just see. So here we are. And then, by holding the breath, one can extend the period of one's life and live hundreds of years. But then, what is the point of such a life if there is no Krishna consciousness? What is that verse from the Isupanishad again? It's too long ago, I forgot that verse. Chijivi sets samaha. Have to practice that one. Anyway, it's a verse that what is the point of living a very long duration of life if it is not engaged in the service of Krishna? Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was only 48 years on this planet. But how much meaning did his life have? So, I was saying that all of us are being attacked by lusty desires, and that sooner or later we have to deal with lust. So when we have a vision, then we expect that. That at one point lust will address itself, and that we should be ready for it then. And how are we going to deal with it? So, a plan should be made. Right? One should therefore operate in one's spiritual life by a plan. And that plan is based on scripture and also on one's personal nature. And one may consider, well, what kind of situation is suitable for me? Such a plan is made in consultation with the Vaishnavas. But such a plan is important. One must have a plan in spiritual life. Interesting, there is one Back to Godhead, which was published some years ago, and in there is a lecture of Srila Prabhupada, and also an article by Satsarup Maharaj, and both are about making plans. And Satsarup Maharaj is writing this article, how one should make plans for Krishna, and then Prabhupada is giving a lecture how one should not make any plans and totally depend on Krishna. So it's very interesting. Here is a distinct difference between guru and disciple, right in one magazine. So does this mean that the parampara was broken right there in black and white, right? Guru says, don't make plans. Disciple says, make plans. Whew, deviation, right? He's going, 180 degrees turn, totally opposite of what his spiritual master said. No, he's saying the same thing. Therefore, one cannot judge these things so quickly. One must thoroughly and deeply understand the differences. Because Prabhupada said, don't make plans for ourselves, basically. Don't make plans in this material world, and don't try to conquer the material energy by one's own arrangements and plans, but depend on Krishna. But depending on Krishna means make plans to be Krishna conscious, so that we will depend for a lifetime. The vision is, the issue is, how to be Krishna conscious for the rest of my life. This is the question. One may be here today, and one may be the biggest dancer in the kirtan and touch the ceiling, right?
Yes.
You have some of these dancers, they jump so high, they touch the chandeliers, you know. Stop that. Like that. But then, where will they be tomorrow? So we have to last. We have to stay around. So the plan means how to stay for a lifetime. That's a big question. And one must think about this deeply. Every devotee must think and must consult with other Vaishnavas. How am I going to last for a lifetime? This is important. Right? So, yes, and then I said that everyone has this problem of having to deal with lust, but it is not the main problem. The main problem is not lust. The main problem is birth, death, old age, and disease. Right? That is the main problem that we have to deal with. And first, before anything, we have to make sure that that is taken care of. That we are properly dealing to solve that problem. And then, secondary, we may solve all the other material problems that come and make arrangements, but never at the expense of conquering birth and death. Otherwise, we are in trouble. That is the most dangerous type of problem that exists. Valpamasya dharmasya trayate mahato bayat. The most dangerous type of fear is the fear to again take another birth in this material world and to miss the opportunity to go back to Godhead. That is the most dangerous type of fear, that somehow or other we're going to miss this opportunity and not go back to Godhead. So that is to be made the priority. The plan should be, how are we going to go back to Godhead this lifetime? What is it going to take to do that? And then, okay, next to that, we may deal with our nature. We are not against against our nature. We are all for it. Let's have our nature. Right? We're not against making that nature part of life. It must be part of life. Right? We're not impersonalist. But after the priority has been safely established, that we have to go back to God at this lifetime and that we cannot do anything which is against it. If our nature is to act against the interest of going back to Godhead, damn that nature, right? Damn it, right? I mean, condemn it. Condemn that nature at that time. It's condemned. Then that nature is terrible. Then that nature is destructive. Then that nature is hellish. Then that nature is demoniac and is to be given up. Right? But if our nature can be engaged in a favorable way to go back to Godhead, very nice. If we are musicians, okay, you know, if you're a guitar player, play guitar and use it for Krishna, for the glorification of Krishna. If you're an actor, use it for Krishna. Anything, but if there is something in our nature that is difficult to engage in the service of Krishna, then that part of our nature we may have to forget about. If we are a thief by nature, then most of the time we will not be able to use that for Krishna. Right. Very rarely, right? Very rarely can that be used for Krishna. Yes. I mean, I could think of some situation, right? I've been in one. There was one once, somehow or other, there was a cheater. And this cheater became very close to one of our devotees, and The devotee was in charge of a department in India somewhere. And then there was a flat which was in the name of ISKCON. And then this devotee gave a letter to this person, this cheater, that he could stay in this flat as long as he liked. So now it was the time to steal. Somehow or other, we have to steal this letter. We have to get it back, right? Because we can't let this guy live in ISKCON's flat. Okay, put on the mask, put on the striped shirt. Torchlight, where is the letter? Right? Sometimes, even such propensities can be used in the service of Krishna. So, there are no hard and fast rules about what can be engaged and what cannot be engaged. It depends on the situation. It depends on one's intelligence, right? One time, the Ayurvedic doctor said, you have to take this medicine. It's very important for your health, right? Take this medicine. It was in a bottle, and I was supposed to put one cap in a glass of water. I put it in the glass of water. I drank it. I go, ugh, it's alcohol. Ugh, it's alcohol. Disgusting. Anyway, it's Ayurvedic, you know, what can you do? Sometimes these medicines have some alcohol. I guess for medicinal purposes, it's okay. And the next day, again, I put a cap. Well, it doesn't taste that bad, you know. Yeah. The third day, actually tastes quite nice. You know. By the end of the week, the bottle was finished. I was almost ready to get another bottle, you know. So, like this, different things can be engaged in the service of the Lord at different times, at different conditions. So, we are all for engaging our nature in the service of the Lord. And if one is creative, right, then one may be able to go a long way and dovetail one's nature in devotional service. But whatever we cannot dovetail in devotional service, that we have to drop, right? Whether it is our nature or not. But it is my nature, my dear, dear nature. I've had this nature my whole life. Yes, you demon, you had it your whole life. And now you have to give it up. You have to stop being a demon. No more. No. Now you're a devotee. This demoniac nature, you have to give it up. Yes, renounce it. I don't... Oh, how can I? You must. No, but I'm so attached. We don't care. Give it up. You know... Right? What can we do? What can we do? If someone is treating us heavily like that, then he's our well-wisher. He's our well-wisher. Because we cannot be weak and fall prey to our demoniac nature. That's all. Otherwise, nature is a great thing. Nature is part of the plan of the Lord. Nature is part of the design of the Lord. The Lord has designed nature. It is the Lord who is behind nature, and it is the Lord who has given us our nature, and then we went to play with that nature, and then we changed that nature by our activities and covered our original nature with a thick layer of false ego, which is so thick that we cannot even see our true nature anymore. But gradually it will become uncovered and purified by devotional service. So some sacrifice is part of the culture, part of the vision, part of the plan. If one has that vision very strong, like I'm describing some essential points right now, right? That the priority is going back to Godhead and then dealing with the things that come according to our age, Like when I was 10 years old, if I would be 10 years old, I would be hoping that one of you would ring my doorbell today and ask me to come and play outside, you know. I really hope. But now, you know, that I'm 50, if somebody's going to knock on my door and say, Maharaj, you're going to come and play outside today. I'm looking at him like, you know, have you lost it or something? Right? But 40 years ago, this was it, you know. This was it. This would have been, this is what I would have been really most anxious for, you know. Someone's going to ask me to play or what? Right? Are we going to do something today? Yes. So priorities change, totally change, right? Yes. Now I don't want no more romance. But 30 years ago, oh yes, I did.
that? I sure did. Now they forget that, you know. Been there, done that, no more. In this way, different phases of life, different things will address itself. As one's getting older, a sense of security, right? Suddenly, one has a sense of insecurity and wants security, looking more and more for security. Young, we don't care. We can sleep anywhere. I went to Italy without any money, hitchhiking. I didn't care. I slept in Venice on the San Marco Plaza on an old cardboard box, right? I didn't care, you know. I was proud of it, you know. I can travel through Europe without money. I thought it was far out to sleep on cardboard boxes. Now I don't think like that anymore. So, what to say? But something has changed, right? Same person, but a different mentality. So, different moods and different mentalities will address itself to us at different points in time. And a person may become totally opposed to what he was before. So whatever our nature may be, it may be. That's all right. First of all, it is temporary according to our age. And then, so we must understand all these dynamics. If we understand these dynamics in making our plan, then that's different, you know, than if we don't understand these dynamics. Because when lust addresses itself, right, then we say, well, okay, that was to be expected. I knew lust was going to come, right, without a doubt. But I also know that, you know, especially when one is younger, lust is very strong, right, and that then it is more difficult, but that with time it also gets easier. So maybe I shouldn't panic, right? Maybe I shouldn't panic, because there's some vision, yes. But if there's no vision, then when lust addresses itself, then there's just total panic. Here is lust. What am I going to do now? I hope it's going to go away. Otherwise, how can I remain a brahmachari? So the four kumaras, they made a plan. They made a plan. Their plan was, we're going to stay 5 years old. Right? That was a good plan. Right? Very good plan. We'll just stay 5 years old, because in this way we will never be in trouble. Because when you're 5 years old, you can do anything. Right? You can walk in any house. You can take anything. Right? If a five-year-old kid walks in your house and takes an apple, you let him take. Right? But if I come, you know. Like, so the four kumaras, they were free to go anywhere, being 5 years old. Sex desire was no problem, being 5 years old. So they made a plan, and they had enough power to do it. Unfortunately for us, it's too late already. Right? Too late now. We were in Maya when we were 5 years old, and we really had no idea. We didn't have the same transcendental knowledge that the Kumaras had, so too late now. We're already in the age where trouble addresses itself. Now it's too late. Now we'll have to deal with it. Right? We can't escape it like the four Kumaras. So the plan of the Kumaras may not work for us. We may have to make our own plan. But a plan has to be there. And if in this plan there is strong understanding of what the priorities are in life, then we'll have a healthy plan. And this is the way to proceed, obviously. In Switzerland, I need not say such a thing, that the value of a plan, right? I know that here everyone appreciates the value of good planning. So in spiritual life, if there's not good planning, then one can expect that when the material desires address themselves, that one will go, oh, what's happening next? Right? And one's world is shaking on its foundations. But this is the aim. We must be Krishna conscious for a lifetime, completely, more and more, not a little bit, but completely, because we must go back to Godhead. Right? Don't start making a plan with a compromise. Don't start with a compromise. No, there can be no compromise. The plan must be, we're going back to Godhead this lifetime. And everything else, well, as you like. Whatever is comfortable, whatever fits best, whatever you like most, whatever you find most helpful for your nature, etc., and for your progress, etc., fine, fine. In consultation. with the Vaishnavas, so you get good advice. Then we progress in the mode of goodness. Like, I'm almost finished, but I'll talk a little bit about marriage. Sometimes, you know, we see that someone wants to get married, and it addresses itself just like that, you know, like the desire comes, yes, I want to get married. And immediately, the same day, the person starts looking, and the next day, the person already wants to be married. Right? That's not the proper way. That's the mode of passion. The proper way to get married is in the mode of goodness. If one wants to get married, think about it, realize what the entanglements are, and then take time to prepare spiritually, materially, economically, and then, okay, go for your life, and may God bless you, and all these kind of things, right? For better or worse, they say. And all that, that's fine, go for it. But then, at least, when everything is well prepared, then when needs arise, there's already a solution. The solution is already prepared. Like, if I may compare it to management, good management means to manage the future. Average management means to manage the present. Bad management means to manage the past. Right? It's like, if you manage the future and everything is ready, easy. When the winter comes and the fire and the fuel is ready, then let's turn on the heater. But if during the winter, it's cold now, we have to really do something now, bad management. And if you only get the fuel after the winter is over, what's the benefit of that? So, I've made my point, and I'll leave it at that. Let us have a vision in spiritual life, because that will help us to stay devotees for the rest of our lives. And that will increase our chance to go back to Godhead. Any question? Any comment?
Yeah? You spoke of cynical listening. Briefly, you mentioned. I have one question and two questions in one. What is the cause of this cynical attitude, and what is to be done positive life to
overcome it? Okay. Well, I think that. This is the age of Kali. And in the age of Kali, it's very difficult to trust anyone. And actually, every authority that we ever had, right, did not actually know the answers. Our parents didn't know the answers. Our teachers didn't know the answers. The newspapers are cheating. The TV doesn't know. Professors don't know the answers, right? No authority actually knows the answers. So it's kind of natural that an intelligent person gets some doubt. It is said in the discussions between Kapila Dev and Devahuti that doubt is a symptom of intelligence. So therefore, at least not all doubt, but one aspect of doubt. There's also doubt that comes out of material attachment, or due to sin, that one also has doubt. But this kind of doubt that is of being a little cynical is doubt that comes out of experience and of intelligence. So when one has a lot of bad experience, one may become cynical. But one should not carry this cynical attitude forward forever. One should at one point just see that now we're dealing with the absolute truth. Here there's a different dynamics. Krishna consciousness is very authorized. It's not changing. It has been the same for thousands of years. It's based on the scriptures. The acharyas are meant to be the embodiment of the scriptures. So the teachers are fully basing their lives on these scriptures, which have been
followed for thousands of years, etc. And we're seeing that by following it perfectly, they become wonderful personalities. So there's no doubt that this is the truth, and therefore one should, at that stage, give up this cynical attitude. So we need to become convinced. That is why Srila Prabhupada said, blind faith will not do. Right? We need philosophy, we need arguments and reasons to really destroy our doubts, our cynical attitude. But when we thoroughly investigate the philosophy and see it, etc., then we can stop being cynical. So, all right, I can. Now I can give it up. This time it's different. Now I can trust that this is true. Like that, one can conquer a cynical attitude. And that's why no blind faith. Therefore, in Krishna consciousness, we don't ask anyone to start out with faith. Like in another religion, they ask the people basically, are you a believer? Right? Are you a believer? Do you believe? Believe! Do you believe? Right? No, I don't, because it's a matter of the heart. I cannot artificially believe when I don't. My heart has to believe. Right? So my heart will only believe if I'm convinced by arguments. I cannot just be dictated. You must believe. You know, it will not work. So therefore, no blind faith, but with argument and reason, logic, will we be convinced and will we become free from a cynical attitude, from all doubt. Like that.
I listened to this talk about Jung, about Mayavadis. So I don't know if you think the Mayavadi says that he is endless of God and he is praying that everybody is God. But I see often that the devotees, you know, like people say, if one is not a devotee, that he is a
Mayavadi.
I read recently even that Prabhupada was with a disciple in the airplane. So he decided to ask Prabhupada, they're speaking about Mayavadis. So one disciple asked him, Prabhupada, what's actually Aurobinda? A Mayavadi? And Prabhupada said, no, he was not a Mayavadi. Just what he was missing, he had no guru. But actually, he was okay. So and you see that even.
Where did he say that?
Oh, it was in the Prabhupada Lamasa in.
Really?
It was in the airplane.
I'd like to see that.
And so, I mean, even took it into the Dharma, I mean, the four Kumaras, so they're actually in first notice before they became the Hindus. But they were saints. And discrimination between the in first notice and the night of the show, actually, not the same. We can speak about this too.
Yeah, I'll try. Yes, okay, we start with Carl Jung. Of course, Carl Jung was a very nice person, and many of us may have found inspiration in his religion, in his religious mood, right? Without a doubt, because he always stood up for that. There's that famous interview where he is asked, Mr. Jung, do you believe in God? And he says, no. And then it's quiet for 10 seconds. He says, I know that God exists. Right? Many people were very impressed by that. So in that way, very nice. But on the other hand, if we look at the more intellectual explanations of God that he explained, then it is total impersonalism. And at the end of his life, he withdrew and went to live in this tower. He had a leaning towards Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, and he had a leaning towards impersonalism. And he lived in this tower. So whether we want to classify him as totally envious of God or having incomplete knowledge, I think in this age of Kali, it will be very difficult to find a pure Brahmavadi who is in the spirit of the four Kumaras and Sukadev Goswami. They were impersonalists, But they didn't have a grain of envy in their hearts. Not a grain. They were actually totally devoted to the Absolute Truth, and they therefore had no desire for self-aggrandizement. They simply lacked the complete knowledge. But as long as there is some desire for self-aggrandizement, right, that means that has its roots in envy. One should understand. So in this age, to find such a Brahmavadi like Sukadev Goswami and the Four Kumars, I think will be very rare. And I think that everyone may have a touch of Mayavad, every impersonalist, a touch of envy also. Even such a great personality of Jung. Yesterday I was quoting also from Chaitanya Chandradharinataka that envy is hiding in his heart. Right? So it was stated like that, that in this age of Kali, right, even those who look very saintly, that envy is hiding in their heart. So it was stated in the Chaitanya Chandradharinataka. So, of course, I don't know what is in the heart of Carl Jung. And I don't want to not be appreciative, because I felt two persons inspired me very much before I was a devotee, Hermann Hesse and Carl Jung, right? Like many of us, I guess, you know. We all read Siddhartha, and everyone was like, wow. Right, and so many other books you may have read. So, like that, you know, it actually helped. They helped us on the spiritual path, and they helped many people. So, they're also spiritualists. And when they are whether they're contaminated with Mayavad or not, doesn't mean they are demons. We don't want to demonize them. We take them as being inclined towards devotion. So when I threw the term around yesterday, okay, I didn't want to label Carl Jung as a demon. Okay, it's not that bad. Yes?
A doubt regarding making plans. Institutional plants.
I see. No, I never said that the institutional plan should not be considered as being part of the greater plan, right? Obviously, an intelligent person who has no traumas, right? An intelligent person without traumas can think clearly and will appreciate that the institution has been founded by Srila Prabhupada, and that he put so many standards and of his instructions in the culture of the institution. So that this institution is valuable because it contains the instructions of Srila Prabhupada. So one gets the mercy of Srila Prabhupada through the institution, without a doubt. And there are many plans which Prabhupada introduced through the institutions for devotees, like Mangalarati and so many other things, right? So I never meant that in our individual plan we should not incorporate the institutional plan. But I also think, though, that we should remember that although there is an institutional plan, that we are individuals, and that we also have to look at our own individual nature and needs within the institution, or in our relationship with the institution, that we should also investigate. In the old days, we used to equate Krishna consciousness with how much you were part of the institution. Later on, we realized that actually we have to be individually Krishna conscious, take help of the institution, and we own a debt to the institution, because it is that institution that has supported us when we had no Krishna consciousness at all, and we should again make a contribution to the institution. So these kind of dynamics are also there, part of the plan. So in the greater plan, there must certainly be that element of what am I going to contribute to ISKCON? One should make a contribution to ISKCON for the sake of Prabhupada, without a doubt. That should be part of the plan. So the plan, the package, contains these things. It must be a foolproof package, you know, nicely with all the elements in there. But some people, see, when ISKCON, and ISKCON today, is still, ISKCON exists on a few levels, on the level of the organization made by people, and on the level of the spiritual movement with the teachings of Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya's mercy. On the level of the teachings of Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya's mercy, it's a perfect movement. On the level of the organization by people, well, you know, there are many things that are going on, and we have to, somehow or other, be part of it and try to help to improve things, and sometimes you have to tolerate things, and you know, it's not only always wonderful, there are also some problems in ISKCON. There are people with false egos who have used that a position of authority to put others down, and I mean, so many problems we have seen, right? So we have to learn how to deal with devotees. We have to, as representatives of the institution, we have to learn how to accommodate devotees. So many things. So sometimes one has to, on the organizational level of ISKCON, we have to work on the situation. Right? We have to work on it. On the spiritual level of ISKCON, being the institution that preserves Prabhupada's teachings and institution, teachings and tradition and instructions, and that which carries the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There is no doubt. On that level, ISKCON is perfect. But on the organizational level, we are trying and still need to learn many things, I think. One has to be balanced, right? and intelligent in all these things. But certainly, we should not just say, no, it's my individual plan, and I've got nothing to do with this institution. That's a mistake. That's a mistake. It's not what Prabhupada made the institution for. That's being more intelligent than the arrangement that Prabhupada made. So that's over-intelligent. But sometimes a person, due to some history, has a reason why he cannot function in the institution directly, and he stays at a distance of the institution. And Prabhupada said, as long as he's following four regulated principles, 16 rounds, he's still properly situated. There were such devotees also in Prabhupada's presence. But that's not the common plan. That's a very individual plan for someone who has a problem of functioning in a temple community, or either in or being related to a temple community even. You can either live in it, or you can live next to it, or you can have some relationship with the temple, but it's very beneficial. The deities, deities are deities. We may have deities of Lord Chaitanya here, and we may have deities of Lord Chaitanya at home. But we should know that the deity is reciprocating with the devotees. Right? And as the deity is being worshipped, the deity will reciprocate. So in the temple, the deity is worshipped on a high standard by many devotees. Right? And there's lots of congregational chanting. Therefore, in the temple, through the deity, the Lord especially manifests himself. And at home, the deity worship standards may be a little lower and a little less. And therefore, we may have our relationship with our own deities, but still the deity in the temple is special. Special. And one should not think that we do not need the mercy of these Gauranitas, the ones in the temple. That's a misunderstanding. Because the deities manifest according to how they're worshipped. That's great.
Bhakti did this, I practically don't believe the Aspirin India. So I know that the same problem, I wish it's different. Temple of Krishna, but this, to many, honestly, so to many, Krishna, I don't feel attraction, I don't think that they are beautiful, so how can I overcome this material vision?
Yeah, but you know, it is also because the worship is not so much happening. Like if you go to a Birla temple in India, then you know that they're not cooking for the deities. You know, they're just giving out these little sugar sweets. You know, like, you know, and standing there, it's nice, but okay. Very nice. But when you go to Radha Govinda temple in Jaipur, right, where the mood is like so alive, you know, and everybody is just so enthusiastic, and then you want those ladus, you know. And if somebody brings me a ladu from Govindaji, then I go, hey, you know, hey, are there more? But if someone brings me a few of those little white sugar crumbs from the Birla Mandir, pranam. Nice, very nice. That's not the same. No, with respect. No, not offensive. Not like not respecting the Lord, but I cannot respect the quality of the offering. Right? Yes, I accept as the deity of the Lord is there, but the quality of the offering is not very appropriate, not very nice. When I was in with some people from the Arya Samaj, and they were telling me that already for 32 years we are changing the cloth of the deity every Purnima. And I go, oh my God. And they were proud, you know, they're telling me very proud, you know. I go, my God, you know. Yeah, so it's like, what can I say? Krishna will withdraw himself a little bit from that deity form. It's not that Krishna is obliged to manifest himself through the deity. It's his kind mercy. And the more the devotees reciprocate, the more he will also reciprocate, without a doubt. Okay, we'll stop with that. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.